first half follow. And all planting would take place in the same time of the year. The three-field system was that you would plant wheat or barley in the winter in one-third of the field. You would plant oats, legumes, and what have you in the second third of the field, and you'd leave the third part fallow, and then rotate the crops that way. The planting of the legumes fertilized the soil, and the spring crop of the oats had various effects. First of all, as we just learned, it was a major nutritional food for humans, but even more important, it allowed the transition from oxen to horses. Oxes eat grass and are much less efficient as a power machine than a horse. A horse can last longer and goes faster. They have about the same strength, but the horse is longer and faster. But a horse needs food, and a horse eats oats, as you may not remember, but horses eat oats. Therefore, but of course, to use the horse, you needed to develop a new type of harness, because the harness that was suitable for oxen was not suitable for horses. And then finally, at a little later stage, as he points out, you needed somehow to protect the hooves of the horse, so you had to invent horseshoes. But the major shift was the transition from two-field agriculture to three-field agriculture.
On the same year, or...?
No, the cycle, if you go back here, he explains it, I don't need, yeah, here if you turn back, the explanation is on his page, on my page. Here, my page 44. The three-field system of crop rotation has been called the greatest agricultural novelty in the Middle Ages in Western Europe. It bursts upon us in the late 8th century, the first secure indication of it being datable in 763, the next comes in 783, the third in 800. Thereafter, the evidence of it is so frequent that those historians who hold the dogma that nothing in rural life can change quickly are required to believe the three-field system is a much earlier invention, which has managed to elude the records. Okay, and then he explains what it is. That is... On my page 45, there was nothing comparable to the three-field rotation in Roman times. Pliny tells us that the people of Trier once sowed grain in March after the winter crop had been destroyed, but this is recounted as a most unusual episode. Okay? How did the three-field system work as compared with the older Mediterranean two-field system? Under the two-field plan, I'm reading from his page 71 on my page 45, under the two-field plan, about half the land was planted with winter grain, while the other half was left fallow. The next year, the two fields simply exchanged functions. Under the three-field plan, the arable was divided roughly into thirds. One section was planted in the autumn with winter wheat or rye. The following spring, the second field was planted with oats, barley, peas, chickpeas, lentils, or other broad beans. The third field was left fallow. The next year, the first field was planted to summer crops, the second field was left fallow, the third field was put into winter grains, and so on. So that was the rotation. So there was a shift from a two-step rotation to a three-step rotation. But one of the main consequences of this, well, there are several consequences. One, that this was a much more efficient use of the land. They just got more use out of it. They were using basically two-thirds of the land at all times instead of half, by making this three-field rotation. Secondly, they were improving the nitrates in the soil by planting the legumes.
So they still had two crops of wheat one year?
They had one crop of wheat and one crop of oats and legumes.
Yeah, but then the two-field system was also could do that, no?
They didn't. Oh,
no, they planted
it. They only planted the winter. So, first of all, this was a more efficient use of land. Secondly, it allowed the transition from oxen power to horse power, which was much more efficient. Thirdly, it provided, as we saw in the Pasuk in Yechezkel, a much more stable and broad diet. Because the legumes and the oats provided the necessary proteins which were not available in the grains.
It's also more efficient use of labor.
And it's also more efficient use of labor. So this made a huge change, and therefore it's safe to say that by the time of Rashi, oats, which had been a negligible cereal in Jewish history up until that time, because it was never planted in Israel anywhere else, was a particular staple. Right. All right. Now we have a number of other consequences of this. One thing that we saw in the Encyclopedia Britannica is that you can't make ordinary bread from oats. You can make biscuits from oats, but they don't rise. Oats don't become hummus. Now notice the consequence of this. A consequence of this is that up until this false identification of oats as shibolet shual, you had a clear distinction between grain flour, wheat or barley flour, which rises and become chametz, and other types of flours, like pea flour or lentil flour or other things, which simply don't rise. The Mishnah itself says this becomes chametz and that doesn't become chametz. Once Rashi has introduced the idea that oats, because of this change in economic circumstance, has introduced the idea that oats are one of the Chamesh Etaminim, are the Shibolet Shual, then of course, what is the difference between oat flour and pea flour? They both don't rise. They both are nutrients. They both planted in the same season. Therefore, says Chaim, the whole origin of our custom, Ashkenazi custom, of prohibiting kitnius on Pesach, also is a consequence of this transition from the two-field system to the three-field system. It's basically a combination of two things, this major economic change which was taking place in Europe, and we find, for example, that this custom of prohibiting kitnius was never initially widespread amongst the Ashkenazi communities. It popped up here and it popped up there. Now, I can't verify the details that it popped up exactly in those places where the three-field system had taken over from the two-field system, but it's a reasonable hypothesis.
Sfardim didn't have that
problem. Sfardim never had this.
They didn't have oats.
They didn't have oats,
yeah,
exactly.
But kidneys.
That's right, kidneys, well, according to, they eat rice and they eat beans, yeah, and everything, exactly. But I'm trying to explain this, you see, it's always a mystery as to what the origin of this strange custom of the Ashkenazim is to prohibit peanuts and peas and lima beans and lentils and all of those things. And it's all due to a combination of two circumstances. One is the transition from the two-field system to the three-field system, so that oats became widespread, and they were planted with lentils. All of these things were planted together, as we just seen.
But didn't Rashi know that it didn't rise? That we put yeast and it doesn't rise? That's something of the same thing.
He saw a name which was one of the major grains, and for him, oats was one of the
farmers.
Even if he wasn't, even if he were a farmer, he may have been a wine grower instead of a farmer. He was a wine grower instead of a farmer. But it doesn't matter. The fact is that since oatmeal was one of the major parts of the staples of the diet at that time, you had a list of five. You're missing the oats, well, presumably the shibolet shual should be the oats. So it's a very interesting hypothesis. I think, to my mind, this explanation of Chaim's is the best explanation that I've ever heard as to how our custom of prohibiting kitnius on Pesach is all based on this combination of economic change and a mistaken identification. And therefore, confusion. I mean, once you've identified shual as oats, then it's hard to distinguish in practice between oat flour and pea flour, for example. Okay, so that's a novelty here. Okay.
Aside from another standpoint, we mentioned about land, fowl, leaving the land for fowl as being a, first of all, it's good for the earth, so forth. Is there any relationship in these cycles to Shemitah, like the 7 year?
You're asking whether our laws of Shemitah from way back, they probably had a similar agricultural.
The effect was the same. The effect wasn't for that reason.
We don't know what the reason was. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like saying that Shabbos is because of labor relations. You don't know what the reason was. But obviously, the question of keeping the land going and not extracting all the nutrients was part of what may have very well, good agricultural practice may have very well been part of the.
Didn't the Romans and the Greeks make fun of the Jews that didn't want to work there?
Yeah, well, that was a later development. You asked me all the way back, we just don't know. How do I answer that kind of a question without getting into trouble?
So because oats became a popular grain, even though it didn't rise, now we look at other grains that also didn't rise and dragged them into the whole
That's
subject.
That's my theory,
it.
Yes. Uh-huh. So, it's all, I'm not saying go out and eat peanuts on Pesach. Our custom is not to do it, but this is how it presumably got started.
And how was it that arose last year from Kidney?
Right.
And a mixture of an Ashkenaz with a Sephardi family.
Well, I brought a tshuva here at the end from Rav Avadya Yosef as to how whether you an Ashkenazi when you're invited to did I print it here? I don't remember. Maybe I didn't print it.
But the oils of Kidneyot are okay, right?
Big problem.
Well,
it's not black and white.
It's not. It's depends who you ask. It is black and white. That's
my problem came under. I've been guy.
Okay.
The rebel out of it.
Rav Cook got blasted when he tried to allow the use of sesame oil in a situation where had they ground up the grain and made oil by the same procedure that they made the sesame oil, there would have been no problem with chametz because there was no liquid ever came in contact, no water ever came in contact with it. But nevertheless, the Eda HaCharedis in Yerushalayim used this as one of the modes of attacking Rav Cook while he was still the Rav in Yafo. So let's not get into politics. But this is... Right. Okay. So at any event, one consequence of this practically is that on oatmeal you would not make a bracha of borei minei mazonos. On farina you might, well, but not on oatmeal. Okay, now let's go back to our Mishnah. In
so what would you say? Borei
kriyadama? We'll discuss it. Either borei kriyadama or shahak will probably borei kriyadama.
Oatmeal every morning for breakfast, so. But I'm making bread. What practical speaking bread?
Yeah. Do you eat? What bracha do you make?
it wasn't Baruch Pi Adam.
Okay. Well, since if you make a shakal, you can't go wrong. But if you were following Rashi and making a borei min hamazonos, then you would, on the basis of the new scientific evidence, presumably change your practice. Okay. Let's go back to my page 2. We're not done with the problem. Problems. This is our first problem. Our first problem is a contradiction between modern archaeological and science and philological and evidence and the explanations of the Rishonim. But I think on this we have to just come down on the side of Professor Felix. That it seems convincing.
Is he 1911?
No, he's still alive, I think. I saw him. I haven't heard that he's not alive. So,
so if you're baking with oats, granted you're not.
If you make oatmeal cookies, you don't take challah on an oatmeal. According to Professor Felix, whose position we are following, then you would not take challah on oats, and you would not make a borei minei mazonos on an oatmeal cookie. Unless it contained a substantial amount of wheat flour. But if it was a pure oatmeal flour cookie, you do not make a borei kriyadam.
But what about, or from oatmeal?
I mean, you don't make a borei minei mazonos. Yes, what?
Or from oat matzah.
On oat matzah, you don't make anything other than a shahak. It's not the principal usage. On an oatmeal cookie, I don't know whether making cookies out of oatmeal is a principal usage, in which case it would be a bari kwi hadama, or whether it's a minor usage, in which case it would be a shahata. But the new chiddush from tonight is that it's definitely not a bari minei mizaron, which is against all of the rishonim and all of the achronim and everybody else, but it's what our modern scientific evidence tells us. Okay? All right, so we thought we knew what Shibolet Shual was, and now we found out that we didn't. Now there's a separate problem, which is a classical problem. It has nothing to do with modern science, but it has to do with simply explanation of the Mishnah. Let's go to Mishnah Hay, my page 2. This is also a major problem, but this is an old major problem as opposed to a new major problem. Isa shetchilata sufkanin v'sofa sufkanin. If you have dough, which is originally, I guess, sufkanin is the best translation, a sponge cake dough, a light dough that you would make a sponge cake out of, right? Suf, that's sort of a practically literal translation. Yeah, donuts, in other words, a sponge. Yeah. But I think the word sponge cake is as good a close translation as any. But in any event, we know what it means. In other words, this is dough that has not been kneaded into a firm mass, but is a soft dough, which was then baked into a soft cake. Okay? So we understand that if you had such dough, you didn't knead it, but you put it in your mix master and it was still quite soft, and then you poured it into the pie pan and you made some soft cooked sufganiyot, you made donuts or whatever out of it, p'tura min achala. That has no requirement of challah. Okay? Tchilata isa v'sofa sufganin. Tchilata sufganin v'sofa isa chayavin b'chala. V'cheina knofkiyot hayavin. Okay. I'm not going to worry about the knofkiyot. I want to understand what does this phrase mean, tchilata isa v'sofa sufganin, and the reverse. And we can understand something started out being sponge cake and ended up being sponge cake. What does this mean by saying that something started out to be kneaded and ended up being a sponge cake, or vice versa? Under that circumstance, the Mishnah says it is chayav b'challah. And remember, if it's chayav b'challah, then presumably it's considered as bread, and therefore the bracha is amotzi lechem min ha'aretz, and so on and so on. So there are, just the issue, what does that mean, beginning and end?
And as a dough, and after baking.
What? Let's take the first case. Tchilata isa v'sofa sufkanin. What does that mean? Something started out as being bread dough, a hard kneaded dough, and ended up being. Okay.
Sour dough. Okay.
So let's take Mr. Weinstein's explanation. This is basically Rabbeinu Tam's position. Hilatal isa v'sofa sufkanin means that you made a thick dough, a bread-like dough, and you never baked it. You made macaroni. You made noodles. You made spaghetti, right? All of those. You made fried dough. In other words, you took dough, which was bread dough.
It's still that.
It's still that, and you never baked it. If that's what this means, which is Rabbeinu Tam's position, then macaroni, spaghetti, etc. is a motzi lechem min ha'aretz. It doesn't say that. It says chayavim b'chal. It's only tchilato sufkanin v'sofa sufkanin. So if you're interpreting the phrase tchila v'sof to mean the actual production, and that something has the status of bread even though it never was baked, as long as it's used, presumably, it, like something like cake, it can't be something which is just a bite. In other words, there would be a difference, perhaps, between noodles and a soup, where it's not the main ingredient, but pasta, according to this position, which is the main substance of the meal. You sit down to have a nice meal of pasta and you're using it as a substance. If that's the interpretation, then the phrase lechem, as far as hamotzi lechem in ha'aretz, will include various types of pasta and so on, which are never baked. The alternative explanation, of course, is that this may not have something, that bread only becomes bread when it actually is baked, but here, since the hafroshas challah is always taking place while in the dough stage, right, before the thing is baked, then this may refer to intent. In other words, if you intend to use this dough for bread, then it becomes chayav b'challah, and if you then make macaroni out of it, then it doesn't lose its chiyuv for challah, because you originally, when you needed it, intended to use it for bread, so you have to be mafrush b'challah, but if you did make macaroni out of it, it has not become bread. In other words, the issue of what chilav asof means is, according to Rabbeinu Tam, it refers to the physical aspect. If it's a thick dough, then no matter what you do with it later, as long as it's a major ingredient in the meal, even if it never was baked, it has the status of bread. And therefore, spaghetti, macaroni, pastas of various types would have the status of bread, and you have to make a motzi lechem in ha'aretz.
We have a serious problem. My wife makes kichel from a challah dough, and so then she bakes it.
Right. So according to Rabbeinu Tam, if it's a kichel, if it's only used as a cake, then...
But it's firm dough and it's never...
Right, but I said, even according to Rabbeinu Tam, it has to have a... Well, we're just beginning this discussion, so it'll take us a while to get into this. But there's an issue of turita denama. It has to actually be the main source of food, right? It can't be a snack. You can have a heavy dough, which you'd make a bovei min and so on, even if you baked it as a heavy dough. If you had a yeast cake or something which is used as a cake, that's still going to be bovei min and mizonos, because you're not using it as the main ingredient in the meal, but just as a supplement. So therefore, but what we're concerned with, we'll go through it when we get to it in the Gemara, what we're going to be concerned with is not so much cakes, but things like pastas, which do form the main substance of the meal. Okay, so that's the machlokas, and as you say, some people like Maharam Wittenberg would never eat spaghetti without having some bread. Right? In other words, he would not sit down to a meal of pasta without being washing.
That'd be a problem. That'd be a problem.
That's not supposed to be the main part of the meal.
Huh?
Not supposed to be the main part of the meal.
Oh, right. Spaghetti? Certainly is. But I guess
that is really Italian.
I guess spaghetti.
All right. Okay, so I think we'll stop here a little bit early. Next week there's no shiur, because I'll be in New York for Thanksgiving. So then we'll meet again in Mirz Hashem in 2 weeks.
What about your night call with Kirsten? There's nothing in the car for good night's